This is an interview with Bill Moran, president of the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, on May 1st at his home in Greensboro. Bill was formerly... All right, Bill, I guess we're ready to go.
Do you want to follow this checklist that we have here?
Let's follow it. Yes, I think we can. But you can digress as much as you wish.
Do you want to enter in as I'm going along and ask for clarification or so on? Would you like the questions read out so that they are helpful?
I think that's important.
The first question is name, department, rank, or position. The name is William Moran. And if the reference is to the department or position there at Stony Brook, is that it?
Yeah.
I came to Stony Brook in 1966 to work as an assistant to John Toll. I finished graduate work at the University of Michigan in the business school there and had done the MBA up at Harvard before that. In any event, I joined John in 1966, had the tail end of a dissertation to write, and I finished that up by about December of 66. The work I did for John varied a good deal, although a lot of it had from the beginning to do with planning, and particularly that portion of planning that was influenced by formulas and budget models.
Your work at Michigan was in a program for the training of college and university administrators, if I remember correctly.
No, there was a touch of that. There was a center for that in Ann Arbor, and I'd done a little bit of work over there, but chiefly my work was in the business school, and it concentrated in organizational behavior, the theory of formal organizations, and so on. There's some managerial economics, the usual sort of thing that goes into a business degree, but my interest and my dissertation had to do with control patterns in large organizations, and in particular, the control pattern at some public universities that I'd looked at, which I thought were quite interesting, the subject was quite interesting. So I came with that previous work in business at Harvard and then in business at Michigan, but the theoretical interest was in the structure of formal organizations, how they worked, what constituted a healthy one, and so on. So I came to work for John doing general kinds of things, and found myself working a lot on the application of formulas as they would determine the resources of the university, faculty, operating resources, and above all, the capital requirements of the university. The Alex Pond came into the executive vice presidency quite soon after that, and Alex, of course, had been helping John for a long time with exactly those kinds of things. I can remember talking, meeting with Alex in the dining room there shortly after I came on, and I told him what I was doing, what I was planning to do. I had no idea at the time that I was talking to him that he knew 20 times more about the very thing I was working on than I did, and he's a reserved person, so some time went by before I realized whom I'd been talking to. But in any event, he came on into the executive vice presidency job, and what I was doing then tagging in directly with Alex, which was a pleasure and a privilege. And I worked really with Alex from that point on some of the same things, because Alec was working on them. And I picked up a kind of a specialty within that of director of long-range planning, and I had a staff working for me, and I also, for a year or two, really was kind of director of the budget under Alex. So my duties covered quite a lot, both the operating resources, the capital resources, and to some degree, I was drawn into the negotiations with the senior staff at SUNY Central, with whom Alex and John and some others were dealing.
Before you get into that, how was it that you came to Stony Brook? Who brought you there?
I think I was recommended by some folks at Michigan to John. And how the first interview was set up, I'm really not very sure, but I knew that it was a developing, burgeoning operation. That interested me a great deal. I met with John, and we hit it off. he was then, and he still is, a lovely man, and I liked what I saw very much. So it was done really about that quickly. I was getting out of Michigan with a PhD, and I needed a job, and this is exactly what I wanted to do, exactly that sort of thing that John was offering me. So it was a lovely fit, and I liked everybody that was there, including yourself.
I remember you.
Yes, I liked everybody that I met. So that's where I came from, and it was with the things in mind that I actually did do that I came. I came there, as I said, in 66. I gotten out of Princeton in 54. Had 3 years in the Navy, and then the Harvard Business School, and then I worked for a consulting firm for a couple of years in New York. Went back to Harvard, worked at the Graduate Business School there for a while, and then got the PhD. So in 66, I was about 34, had some quite interesting experience, but was really just starting out in what was my chosen field, which was university administration. So as I look back on it now, it was sort of a tardy entrance into the field, but I've been doing a lot of other things, and was satisfied with it. By the time I got there, I was also satisfied that that's where I wanted to be, more than anything else. So I was 34 when I got there. Been married 2 or 3 years and was just starting in with my own family. From what institution and position did you come? Well, from the University of Michigan, but no particular position there. I went out there to do the PhD and called a little bit upon the Center for the Study of Higher Education there, but I wasn't functionally connected with that.
Was Alger Henderson?
Alger Henderson was running that at that time, and he was a first-rate figure. He put that center together. It's still the best in the country, largely because he put it together, I think. He was there and taught one course that I took over there, and we thought very well of each other.
You knew that it was his function as Associate Commissioner for Higher Education that was taken over by the Board of Trustees in 48 under Dewey?
I had some dim understanding of that.
He was Associate Commissioner for Higher Education in 48 when the legislation was put through.
Mm-hmm.
Took all the operating functions away from him, mm-hmm. Placed them under a separate Board of Trustees with its own executive officer.
I didn't recollect that, Carl. That's very interesting. He was a remarkable figure, and I just brushed up against him in Michigan, really in the last stages of his career there as an administrator. He had put that center together, and it has prospered ever since. So I came from Michigan, from a kind of traditional PhD in business, but with some exposure to Aljo. Indeed, it might have been Aljo who made the connection for me. I honestly don't remember how I got there, but it might have been. Who was primarily responsible for my coming to Stony Brook? I suppose John, although all of the people who met with me then, including yourself, and I think Sheldon Ackley, and there probably were some others too, made the decision. The next question has to do with who interviewed me for that position, and I recall you and, as I said, Sheldon and John. I came because it really looked like, if it wasn't the only game in town, it was certainly going to be one of the most interesting games in town, thinking of town as the United States. It was clear that everyone at Stony Brook, and I thought those at SUNY Central, were aiming very, very high. I thought that the aim was to produce the best in a research university that could be found. There were some other models around for that, of course, Ann Arbor, where I'd been, Berkeley, and so on. I don't know that anybody was aiming at a duplication of that, but as far as the quality of it was going, everybody that I talked to at Stony Brook had that in mind. And I liked that, and that had a good deal to do with my going. There was a personal angle to it, too. Barbara's parents and my own were in the East. Barbara's on Long Island, and mine in Westchester County. And that had some bearing on it, but I think chiefly it was the professional excitement of the thing that did it. So it was the vision, really, that I thought the Stony Brook people had that excited me, and the scale and the predictable dynamic of the thing. I mean, I was looking to learn, and it was very clear that a whole lot was going to happen there in a short space of time, and it did. And I could not have been in a better place to pick up an awful lot about how good universities function, what they need in the way of resources, and how even the governance systems of the university can be put together. That was a special problem at Stony Brook, but I learned a lot about that. We might talk about that again at a later point, but every aspect of what's important in a university was exposed in those 5 years, and more than exposed, was of operational significance, and I was conscious of that. I will just say this too, I don't suppose I was confident that it was all going to be brought off. I knew what everybody had in mind. I wasn't experienced enough really to know how difficult
were the roadblocks were.
Yeah, I didn't know much about that.
Right.
But I knew what the aims were. As to the impressions of Stony Brook on the campus, the people, the leadership, and the spirit, they were obviously very positive when I was deciding to come. After I'd been there a while, of course, I had a deeper understanding within a year or so of what was actually there. In large part, it correlated with what I thought I saw, although it was different in some respects. It was a much more fractious place internally. What you might call the political or the managerial side of the thing, of bringing off the vision there, looked to me after a year or so much more difficult, much more time-consuming than I might have imagined originally.
Can you be specific in defining the word fractious? You're talking about the campus?
Yes.
You're talking about, all right.
I am talking about the campus, yes. It seemed to me after a year and beyond that point that it was not an academic community that was at peace with itself. Indeed, it was hardly an academic community in the sociological sense of that term. In one sense, it was, obviously, but... And I've thought about this a lot since, but I had a sense of it at the time. Good universities become good, normally, over a long period of time. They're quite complicated organizations, logistically, programmatically, structurally, very complicated. And because they are complicated, it is just intrinsically and was intrinsically difficult to put them together rapidly. And one of the consequences of that, of being unable to call together, overcome that problem, one of the consequences was that the kinds of understandings which pervade an established university about how things will be done, how faculty and administration will relate to one another, how work orders will be put through, how new programs will be initiated, and how they'll be evaluated, financed. All of these things had to be learned rather rapidly there. And it's very difficult to learn that rapidly. Indeed, impossible to learn it rapidly without strain. And there was a lot of strain. And that's what I'm talking about when I say fractious. I think the signs of the strain of bringing together so many people so rapidly and trying to get those people familiar with one another, trusting of one another, proved to be very difficult to do in a short period of time.
Did you know Myron Doucette?
Very well. I did. Funny you should mention him. Why do you bring him up?
Because I hired him. And he was assistant to the president for scientific equipment. Mm-hmm. He just came in up. He was a walk-on. After he retired from Schroeder. And he was just the man we needed.
Yes, a lovely man.
Yeah.
Lovely man. I was there when he died, and I felt that one because I thought he was a very high-quality person. Yeah, I did know him and counted a privilege to have known him. And I think about him now and again. So that was my impression of the campus. The people, I thought, were of professionally a very high quality. Though they were not all at ease with one another, individually of a very high quality. The leadership is a part of this question, and that's really a very interesting one. John Toll was the leader, and he was and is an extraordinary figure. He had not been there long when I got there. I'm not sure when did he come.
65.
So he'd gotten there. Well, only about a year before I did. But he was clearly in charge when I got there. I found in John a person of extraordinary mental energy, astonishingly retentive memory. Formidable man in an argument. With more energy, mental and physical, than anyone I'd ever seen before. And a kind of tenacity and boldness that I thought were extraordinary. He had as well something that I thought was in its own way even rarer than the things I just mentioned. I found him to be an immensely civil person. Courteous, thoughtful, and above all modest. So he struck me then and seems to me now an extraordinary figure who was certainly going to accomplish great things somewhere, if there was any justice in the world at all. And he had set out, I think, and thought at that time, to do that at Stony Brook. So I liked what I saw in the way of leadership there. Now, leadership is to some degree, Carl, a cultural phenomenon in that it, when it's most successful, is custom fit to circumstance. The same person is not the proper leader everywhere. It's a very circumstantial kind of thing, assuming the basic skills and talents that some of which I've been talking about here. John had all of the things that a young campus needed going for him. he was, he did have his foot to the floorboard. He was driving it forward. It wasn't just happening to him, he was doing it. He was pressing it forward, and so was Alec. Largely conscious of the risk of the high speed, but he had his reasons, and we could talk about those. But he knew what he was doing anyway, and he was doing it very consciously. he liked to work with a certain degree of crisis in the air. Partly because he enjoyed that, and partly, I think, because he could keep those around him at a pitch that occasionally would approximate his own energy and intensity level. Maybe it was partly chemistry, too. Some people are what they are for reasons that have a lot to do with genes and such things. But he did work that way. But that didn't trouble me very much. I relished it. But I think it did grind some people down. It did drain the energy out of some, and it did short some tempers occasionally, and it made him a tough guy to deal with, for others to deal with.
If you think in terms of balance between the effort directed in the direction of the sciences, social sciences, humanities, can you say anything about his even-handedness or his confidence in pushing in all three directions?
Mm-hmm. It was clear to me that he was aiming at a high level of quality in all directions, but he knew more about what that was in some directions than others. And in addition, I think he had more of a spiritual or intellectual sympathy with the scientists, perhaps, than with the social scientists and the arts and letters people. But he wanted high quality in all areas. He simply knew more about it in one area than another. And there's nothing unusual about that.
No,
we're all that way.
I think that's a good analysis.
The next question, number 9, asks about what events or persons or experiences stand out in my mind. of course, been touching on some of those obliquely. The sense of urgency, and more than a sense of urgency, the real presence of urgency. Tremendously important decisions were being made.
Faith had to catch up.
Yeah, there was. That's right. That pervaded Stony Brook, I think. Saturated the place. It was partly John Toll, but it was John Toll in the right, responding to the right signals from the state of New York and from SUNY. John and Alex, of course, both felt correctly that at any time the situation could change in some important fashion, and the resources which were needed to do what they wanted to do might be turned off. That was another reason for the accelerator being hard against the floorboard. So there were a whole lot of reasons, but that sense of pressure and urgency and the need to accomplish a lot fast is certainly the outstanding impression that I'm left with as I look back at that. The struggle with central administration, of course, was another feature of my years there, which I was very conscious of and had something to do with, although I was mostly working with John and Alec, who were the contact people. There were great sums of money and great programmatic issues at stake. John, of course, had an answer on all questions and was urging that answer on everyone in sight, and putting, in his own way, great pressure upon the key figures at the staff level working for Gould at Central Administration.
Remember who they were?
Yes. I'm trying to remember now the name of a very fine gentleman who was in charge of planning up there. I'm sure you know him. Died of a heart attack at too young an age. Is it, you know,
it wasn't David Price.
No, Price was there. Price was there. But it was chiefly Lineberry. It had it started with an L. A sort of scholarly-looking fellow with glasses in charge of long-range planning. And basically it was he who was negotiating with Stony Brook these formulas which produced such important financial results. No, it wasn't Lankford. I'll have that for you, Carl. We'll give it to you. He was a very good man, and he was put under terrific pressure by everybody and by John to do what we felt was needed at Stony Brook.
To deal with Axelrod or Adenauer?
Yes, both. Axelrod was, I thought, the stereotypical state budget bureaucrat. Person of some intelligence, affable, but bristly, and not especially sympathetic to what was being tried, suspicious.
Of what?
Suspicious of being taken to the cleaners. Yeah. Adenauer, of course, was running the construction fund, was an important figure, and John was dealing directly with him. But in any event, the relationship of the leadership at Stony Brook with Central Administration and SUNY was a very stressful one. It wasn't full of trust, although the people at both ends, I thought, well of each other, but they had slightly different things in mind and slightly different responsibilities. And so their views were not easily reconciled.
How many individuals in the central office do you remember as being university-trained individuals?
There were some. The provost, who was key for a while, was an historian. You probably remember him.
Harry Porter.
No, no. Porter was there, but I'm thinking of maybe the one who came after him, who went to, was it Queens College and was I think he did the Jefferson papers. Well, in any event, I haven't gotten a name now. Red-haired fellow, thinning red hair. It wasn't Jefferson Papers. It was after he left Stony Brook, he finished that up. But he was a real academic person. The others there, I guess I wouldn't call them remarkable academic figures in the sense that this provost was. But they were not they were not fools, and they were not ignorant of what was at stake. But you know, in a sense, Carl, the events were overwhelming people, and what they knew about academic standards or about how universities function, it was almost irrelevant because things were moving so fast.
Who is the chap that has been president of Delaware and came up, or dean of Delaware? Deering.
Just a name. I did not.